Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Masha Gessen is a staff writer for The New Yorker who was born in Russia and has been covering that nation and its politics for us for years, up to and including the war in Ukraine. I reached Masha in Kyiv last week. Masha, it's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, David.
You've been visiting Kyiv for years and years, and now you're there during wartime, and the streets of Kyiv are said to be quiet as opposed to so much of the country in the east and in the south. What is daily life in Kyiv now?
Daily life in Kyiv, at first glance, is perfectly normal. Cafes are open, hipsters are in the streets, it's sunny, it's beautiful. 3-4 times a day you hear the air raid siren, no one pays it any mind. You dig a little deeper, it's obviously not all so peaceful and so wonderful. There's small things that you notice at first, if you pay attention. There are very few kids. The women with children, who were the bulk of the refugees, they haven't returned. You notice, for example, that the lines at the gas stations are pretty long. The gas is incredibly expensive. And so that sheds a completely different light on all these young people shuttling around on electric scooters, which are, you know, Bolt is working here. People are renting scooters. But part of the reason they're renting scooters is because cabs have become few and far between and private cars are very difficult to use. So it's this resumption of civilian life that is so much more difficult than life was just 3 months ago, even if sort of at first glance it looks almost exactly the same.
Now, you've also been getting out of town. How do things change?
Well, just beyond Kyiv, there's just unimaginable destruction. I mean, it's comparable to what I saw, for example, in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, after the second war, after they'd had 10 years of carpet bombing. I mean, it's just absolutely devastating. But you've seen all those pictures, right? What you don't see unless you're here is how you pass from this totally pristine area where everything seems to be perfectly intact into an area that has been completely devastated.
What are you hearing in terms of overheard conversations in cafes, restaurants, the streets?
Yeah, so what you hear is talk about war. A lot of people, I'm assuming, are getting together for the first time since they came back. So you hear a lot of people retelling the story of leaving the city, how they got out, when they got out. It's always some sort of dramatic story depending on what people's circumstances were, but it's always dramatic. And then if they're not talking about that, they're talking about what missiles the U.S. is sending, where this battalion could have been posted, should have been posted. The other night, there were these two absolutely beautiful women sitting at the table next to me. I mean, they looked like supermodels. They were completely, you know, in total full makeup, the way that only Ukrainian women can be, in just, you know, in utter perfection. And then I hear them say, Bucha, Irpin, right? These places that have become synonymous with just horrific war crimes. People talk about war crimes all the time.
What are they describing? What are the particular acts?
Well, people describe the random murder of civilians. People talk about rape. They talk about being robbed. They talk about being held hostage. They talk about torture. They talk about what's happened to them. They talk about what's happened to their friends and relatives. I mean, the scale is just undigestible. It's not something that the national justice system can digest. It's not something that the international justice system can digest. And it's certainly not something that the human mind and heart can digest.
When you talk to people in Kyiv, what do they expect is ahead for them?
In Kyiv, a lot of people refer to the war in the past tense and then catch themselves and say, well, yeah, of course, the war is still going on. It's entered that stage of war that Ukrainians are used to, which is war is elsewhere, and you know where it is. Like, you know how to end up at war. It's not, the war is not coming at you, or at least not right at this moment. I'm told that it's very different. We're about to travel east and south a little bit, and I'm told it's very different in places that are closer to the front. People are afraid to talk to journalists. People are afraid to talk about what happened to them because they're quite convinced that it could happen again.
Recently, Henry Kissinger said at Davos that Ukraine would have to reconcile itself to giving up territory in order to find a peace with Russia. I can only imagine what the reaction to this was in Kyiv.
Look, every Ukrainian understands that when you say territory, you're talking about the people who live there. And every Ukrainian understands in gory detail what happens to people in territories occupied by Russia. The very suggestion that you could consign millions or even hundreds of thousands or even one or two people willingly to the torture, the rape, the wanton killing, the humiliation that they have suffered at the hands of the occupiers is, you know, that's just unthinkable.
Masha Gessen, thank you. Be well and be safe.
Thank you, David.
Masha Gessen in Kyiv, and we spoke last week. You can read Masha's reporting at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. When Eric Cervini was working on his doctorate in LGBTQ history, he was surprised by how much had already been published in the field. But really, apart from professional historians, most people, it seemed, didn't really know this stuff. The research was largely in peer-reviewed journals and academic press books. So the obvious solution, he thought, was Instagram.
There was about a 9-month period between when I defended my dissertation and my book was published. And during that time, I said, you know what, let's try this out. Let me put up some videos. I got a green screen. I put it up, ironically, in my closet and said, let me film myself just telling some of these stories and having fun with it, you know, posting goofy pictures. I'm going to pretend like I'm in ancient Greece or in Mesopotamia or you know, ancient Egypt. And people liked it.
Cervini's book, The Deviance War, went on to be a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. But it was his homemade videos that inspired a real full-fledged history series on Discovery Plus. And that's just been launched, and it's called The Book of Queer. Eric Cervini spoke with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman.
So let's hear the elevator pitch for The Book of Queer. What is this show? How do you describe it? It's definitely not something you know, your average documentary on the History Channel.
Mm-hmm. I would describe it as a queer history variety show. And so what that means is, you know, we're telling approximately 15 stories from the past, ranging all the way back to ancient Egypt up until basically present day. And rather than taking the conventional docuseries approach, we do it through reenactments, comedians. They were all written by 12 queer comedians. And camp, humor, drag, and song. Every episode ends with a musical, an original choreographed musical number.
Open our book and dazzle your mind. History's about to be redefined. Think you know the truth about the past? Honey, better think again. We're shining a light on queer lives at last. Dishing drama from now till then. These pages are full of many courageous stories of glory that are all right on. Welcome to the Book of Queer.
Yeah, you have some great, like, queer celebrities on the show. Could you tell me about some of them and what they do on it?
Sure. I mean, there's so many. So every episode is narrated by a different high-profile member of the queer trans communities. And they're helped by 18 historians help actually narrate these stories along with Miss Vanjie and Gottmik and some of these incredible drag queens and comedians who also narrate it.
Anyway, communities crave identifiers, and the queer community is no different.
Darling, I'm the rainbow flag. Look at me. I'm the reason you can spot a gay bar from a mile away.
Today, the rainbow flag is the most recognizable queer symbol. But it was hardly the first. Back in the day...
Excuse me, can I speak for myself without you near explaining everything.
Well, excuse me, Miss Rainbow Flag, but I am narrating.
Anyways, to understand how truly powerful I am at uniting different queer communities, we need to first visit a few of those earlier symbols and groups, or as I like to call them, my yester-queers. Rewind that and do better.
Okay.
So I want to dig into some of the history and some of the people that you cover on the show. First of all, can you explain how the high five got invented?
I'll be honest, I learned so many new stories as part of the story. You know, the first thing we did was collect hundreds of these queer stories with a team of researchers. And I didn't know this one. And it's the story of Glenn Burke, an incredible baseball player who played for the Dodgers. And what people don't realize is that in the 1970s, the high five was not really a common form of communication. It just wasn't something that was really done yet. And at the World Series, Glenn Burke brought it to America. And it was the first time. No one really knows why he raised his hand in the air to congratulate Dusty Baker, but he did it. And this is a gay black man who did this. And, you know, we tell that story as kind of, all right, this is the inventor of the high five. But I think even more important is his entire life story of what happened to him next.
Right. So what did happen to him next?
If you're a relatively open gay black man playing in the MLB in 77, 78, and, you know, the management of the team learns this, you can guess what happened. And it's not a pretty story. He was traded to the Oakland A's. You know, he was the soul of the Dodgers, and they kicked him out.
During a 1982 interview on the Today Show, Glenn spoke publicly about his queerness.
The people that you like and live with and work with might not understand, you know, the problem of being gay and a professional baseball player. It came to the point to where I was uncomfortable. I thought that the world should know how I felt. So when I got fed up with the situation, I thought I'd tell people about it.
It's a hard story, especially, you know, I'm sure you noticed that the MLB didn't participate in the telling the story. They would not allow us to use their footage. Hmm. We couldn't even license it. So that made it even more difficult to tell the story. But, you know, it was an honor not just to learn his story. Of course, he died. I don't want to call it a spoiler, but I mean, he dies, of course, of AIDS, you know? And so it would have been amazing to interview him about it. But fortunately, we had an incredible actor. We had the help of Glenn's family in pulling it off, I think.
One thing that's very interesting to me in thinking about these historical figures is the issue of using very modern terms like non-binary or gender non-conforming or gay or lesbian or bisexual or queer, any of those, to describe people who lived long, long, sometimes centuries, but even, you know, in some cases just decades before they were in popular use. How do people in your field think about that?
I mean, it's been a subject of debate for decades. Can you call someone gay when that word didn't exist? And so one of the very first things we do, and we do it in the very first story, which is Abraham Lincoln, is define the word queer, which just means deviating from that subject's society's norms surrounding gender and sexuality.
Howdy, I'm Eric Cervini, the Book of Queer's resident homo historian. Welcome to the footnotes. You may have noticed that we haven't labeled Abe gay, because that wouldn't make too much sense. Why? Because sexuality, just like race and gender, is what we call a social construct, or a concept that we as a society just came up with. And during Lincoln's time, the idea of a homosexual hadn't yet been conceived or constructed in the English language. That's why we love the word queer. All it means, in the words of queer theorist David Halperin, is whatever's at odds with the normal, the legitimate, the dominant.
So what do we know about Lincoln's sexuality?
Well, we know he had 4 children, so we have to start there. But we also know...
The proof is in the pudding.
Exactly. We also know that he loved 4 men. And the proof is in the letters The proof is in the memoirs written by his contemporaries and by these men themselves. And, you know, the historian who tells this story, Thomas Balcerski, he's a wonderful scholar. He says it always goes back to the bed. When you look at whom was Lincoln sleeping with, it's men. He did not sleep with his wife. They preferred not to. But when his wife was out of town, who did he sleep with? Men. Time and time and time again. And we're very careful about saying, you know, we're not calling him gay. We're not saying even that he was bisexual. What we're saying is that he had four intimate relationships with other men that may have been sexual. And we let people decide for themselves. We call him queer because we do believe that this was beyond even the differences in masculinity back then. This was going beyond even that in terms of his intimacy with these men.
Hmm. So the people on the show, the historical figures, are both people that everybody knows, like, you know, Lincoln and Alexander the Great and Eleanor Roosevelt, but also people who may not be familiar to wide audiences. And I'm wondering, can you tell us about Harry Allen?
So Harry is one of my favorite characters. So Harry was essentially an outlaw, a trans outlaw. His story we identified from a wonderful book by Peter Boag. And he tells these stories of all these gender nonconforming and what we would now use the term trans folks in the West, on the frontier. This is in the late 19th, early 20th century. And Harry is one of those figures who goes out west. Of course, there are fewer laws, fewer regulations. It's easier to live on the margins because there's just fewer structures in place to regulate you. And that's true for not just sexually deviant folks, but also folks who transgress gender norms. And the record is incredible because what happens is he kind of becomes a celebrity in Washington, in Seattle, Portland, kind of traveling all around and just making trouble. He's very much a quintessential trans outlaw, and the newspapers report on it. And there's just this wealth of sources from the press, whether it's, you know, Seattle newspapers, local newspapers, that are just talking about, you know, they would use, quote unquote, this quote, woman who was presenting as a man and created this scandal that people just couldn't get enough of. Just getting arrested, biting cops' hands, causing fights. And he would essentially, anytime he would get arrested, he would say, look, I'm a guy. Like, that's what I am. And they would try to find ways of punishing him, but they never could quite figure it out.
Right. So when the show was announced, Breitbart wrote an article saying that the trailer makes, quote, wild claims about President Lincoln being queer and calls Joan of Arc non-binary. I'm wondering, what was your reaction to that?
I assume and I hope that is the first of many such articles that we get. Because, I mean, look, this, given what's happening in Florida, what has happened there, what is happening in my home state of Texas to trans kids there in Alabama, Arizona, everywhere. This show is a response to a very intentional nationwide attempt to erase not just our history, but our own existence.
If that's not queer, I don't know what is.
The tone of the show is so original. I mean, there's people might recognize elements of like Drunk History and the sort of sketch comedy format, but it's also it also includes a lot of academics, PhDs. It's a footnoted TV show, which I've never seen before. I you know, it's a show that's not told straight in more ways than one, and I was curious if you felt that there was a kind of style of queer storytelling that was important. Like, is there a reason that queer history shouldn't be told straight?
I think when you look at how the folks that were describing their stories, whether it's Jose Saria or, you know, even Harvey Milk or Gil Baker, they use humor themselves to tell the stories. You know, humor is a survival tactic. And so I think humor and queerness are inextricable.
Eric, thank you so much for talking with us. It's a real pleasure, and I look forward to people seeing The Book of Queer.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Cervini talking with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. The Book of Queer is streaming now on Discovery Plus, with new episodes each week in June. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Sarah Nelson started working as a flight attendant in 1996. She had a job with United Airlines working out of Boston, where she roomed with other flight attendants.
I got an apartment with seven other women because that was the only way we could survive, and started my flying career. And about 3 weeks in, my fellow roommates got their first paycheck. And I was so excited to get it, and called my bank account. It was down to $12, I remember, like $12.51 or something like that. So I went into the office and asked somebody, you got to help me. I didn't get my paycheck. So the answer I started to get from the company personnel in the office there in Boston was, well, people get their paychecks at different times for different reasons. We're sure you'll get it next time. And I'm thinking, okay, I remember I'm supposed to watch it, not get upset, not cause a commotion while I'm on probation. I'll try to just smile while I'm freaking out inside.
So it was ramen and meals on the plane until the next pay period. But when that day came, there was still no check.
And so I went straight down into the office and asked, somebody's got to help me. I didn't get my paycheck. And I started to get some of the same answer, you get your paycheck at different times. And I'm like, it's the same rhetoric. And they don't care. They don't see. I'm a person standing here in crisis. And the tears started to roll because I felt pretty desperate. And all of a sudden, I had this tap on the shoulder. And I turned around and there was someone standing there who I'd never seen before. She looked a lot like me. She was wearing the same uniform. And I do remember her union pin sort of shining on top of her wings. And she was asking me how to spell my name. She handed me a check for $800. And she said, number one, you go take care of yourself. And number two, you call our union. And I did call our union. I had my paycheck the next day, but I always tell everyone that that was the moment.
Sarah Nelson went on to become the president of that union, the Association of Flight Attendants. And the AFA represents some 50,000 workers and nearly 20 airlines. And right now, there's a push to unionize Delta's flight attendants. Nelson is a frequent presence on Capitol Hill, and her name often comes up as a candidate to head the AFL's CIO. Staff writer Jennifer Gonerman recently profiled Sarah Nelson for The New Yorker.
One of the first things that the public is usually very surprised to hear is that flight attendants are a highly unionized job. Our union has been in place since 1945 when we first organized at United Airlines and got our first contract in 1946.
Looking back on your early days as a flight attendant, as a young woman, what were the conditions like for you? Did you feel sexually harassed when you were working? Did you ever feel groped by a passenger? Was there much of the kind of passenger violence that we read about now going on, the so-called unruly passengers? What was it like for you as a young woman?
It was passengers thought that there was hands-on all the time. You'd be walking down the aisle, they'd get your attention by touching your rear end. And so some of it didn't feel violent necessarily. It certainly was not something that I experienced anywhere else. But there were also times when it was, you know, it did feel a little bit more violent and intrusive and intentional, like the guy who walked up behind me and while I was setting up the galley before we took off, and he ran his hand along the outside of my hip and right down almost around my rear end and said, "What? No girdle? How can you look this good in your uniform without a girdle?" And it was everywhere. I mean, it was everywhere all day long. And it wasn't that much earlier in the career of flight attendants that airlines were using us as a marketing tool. We were totally objectified, and that's the way that we were treated.
Did you have any recourse in a situation like that? Like, what were you to do?
Never had anything like that happen to me before. No one had ever sort of warned me something like that might happen. But ultimately, you rest on, no one's going to care. No one's going to do anything about this. There's no way this guy's going to be taken off the flight. And so you try to just protect yourself and then tell the rest of your crew, hey, watch out for Hansi and 5F, you know.
Hansi and 5F?
Yeah. Later I found out that continued to persist. And, you know, anyway, that was hard when the Me Too movement broke, and all of a sudden I was the president overseeing a group of people who were continuing to live like nobody's going to do anything about this, and it's something we just have to live with.
You mentioned the Me Too movement. Did you start hearing reports from your members about stories like this, past and present, or what did it unleash within the world of flight attendants and the conversations that started happening?
Well, when the Me Too movement broke, I realized, wow, well, first of all, they're talking about, like, women are sticking together, holding each other up, and all of a sudden, we really get to tell our stories. This is new. Like, people care about this, and they're going to listen to it, and they're going to take it seriously. Wow. We really have a chance to push forward. And so I actually called my communication staff in, and I said, get ready. The phone's going to start ringing. And they're like, what do you mean? And I said, well, they're going to be looking for stories in workplaces. And the first thing they're going to do is say, who should we call about who has probably experienced sexism in the workplace? And they're going to think of flight attendants. And they were like, huh? And sure enough, an hour later, the phone started ringing.
In tonight's signature segment, NewsHour Weekend's Megan Thompson reports on the troubling stories of harassment and abuse taking place at 30,000 feet, where there's often nowhere to turn.
We pushed really hard in that moment and actually called on the industry to denounce the sexist past, lift up our professions of safety professionals, and demand that there be zero tolerance at every airline for any kind of this behavior, so that it would send a message to everyone, whether they were in management levels or in the flight deck or to flight attendants themselves, that they could report this and they would be safe and it would be taken seriously by the airlines. And only three airlines stepped. I mean, I have to say three airlines did step up and do it. You could say it that way, or only three airlines stepped up.
And do you have any sense of how things have changed or not changed in the years since the Me Too movement gained traction? I mean, since you did your survey and going around to various crew rooms, has anything gotten better?
I think that what has gotten better is that more people believe that this will be taken seriously, we've been able to get the FAA to talk about it and take it seriously. We've had legislation passed that increased the fines for this kind of behavior. We got training for flight attendants to recognize and report human trafficking, which in a lot of ways was sort of the same kind of lane about identifying that this is a unique crime, and you have to not only recognize the crime. It's one thing if someone's punched in the face, you deal with the physical impact of that, and you know how to take care of someone at that point. Sometimes you need some training in how to support the victim in a sexual harassment or assault case. And I think what has really changed is that in doing all of this and raising all of these issues, we've been able to actually change the way that the public sees us and talks about these issues. And we started creating a foundation where flight attendants and our union could be seen as powerful.
A man is now banned from American Airlines planes after he allegedly attacked a flight attendant, breaking her nose.
The flight from New York to John Wayne Airport in Santa Ana.
Last year, 2021, there seemed to be an endless stream of stories about passengers, officially known as unruly passengers, but that obviously understates the problem of, you know, violence on airplanes, passengers acting up, refusing to wear a mask, flight attendants sometimes even being injured. And oftentimes it seemed like alcohol was part of the story. Has that situation improved this year?
It has not improved yet. We've done a lot of work, a lot of PSAs with the FAA, communicating the consequences for acting like this.
The FAA is strictly enforcing a zero tolerance policy toward passengers who cause disturbances on flights or fail to obey flight crew instructions.
They know from studying these reports that this is more than about masks. A lot of people were driving the idea that that would cut down on the conflict. We know, and the people on the inside looking at the reports know, that that's just not the case. We've got a lot more work to do to get things under control and make sure that people don't think that when you get on a plane, you get to punch the flight crew.
Back in early April, after the Amazon labor union prevailed in Staten Island, you said publicly that you thought the next big labor fight was going to be at Delta Airlines, where your union has been working with flight attendants to organize. How's that fight going? Can you give us an update on what's been happening?
Off and on, Delta flight attendants have been trying to get a union for 20 years. The last time there was an election was 2010, and flight attendants narrowly lost. The idea that workers can't win was permeating not just at Delta, but across the labor movement, across all industries. So right now, as there's this resurgence in working people standing up and feeling like the corporate elite have taken way more than their fair share, that's the general sentiment. And now that there's all this excitement and we have all these, frankly, younger workers driving this who were not even here for the prior election, there's a lot of momentum. And I believe that the Delta flight attendants are going to file for an election this year. And it's going to be enormous. This is the biggest organizing campaign in one place going on anywhere. Certainly, Chris Smalls is talking about organizing all of Amazon, so 500,000 workers. But this would be one election for almost 24,000 workers at a company that's based in the South, and it's a big deal.
Are they paying close attention to what's going on at Amazon, and how do you think that's affecting their approach?
I mean, listen, union is in the water. All these news outlets for years had stripped away their labor reporting and labor reporters. And so now you've got people who are tech reporters and health reporters, education reporters, and everything else doing labor reporting because it's the hot thing, right? I mean, that used to be really, really difficult to talk about the union busting. You'd almost try not to do it. It was talked about in terms of inoculation. You got to inoculate people against all the union busting that will happen. And what's happening now is that you see at Starbucks and Amazon is these young kids are saying right out front, like,
give us our fair shot. We get free reign to decide here. And they're using the union busting to expose the companies, and they're actually using it as a part of the campaign to build momentum. I mean, you know, Chris Smalls, the fact that Amazon went out and arrested him for giving food to other Amazon workers, that all led to a win because people are seeing how far these companies that have billions of dollars in profits will go to try to keep workers down and keep us from being able to get our fair share.
Sarah, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I always enjoy talking with you.
That's Sarah Nelson, International President of the Association of Flight Attendants. She spoke with Jennifer Gonerman, a staff writer at The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the 1990s, inspired by The Simpsons, an entire wave of animators started making cartoons for adults, and one of those animators was Lauren Bouchard. Bouchard worked on niche late-night shows like Science Court and Dr. Katz's Professional Therapist. And eventually Bouchard took to primetime as the creator of Bob's Burgers, about a family-run burger joint in some seaside town.
All right, listen, you're my children, and I love you, but you're all terrible at what you do here. And I feel like I should tell you, I'd fire all of you if I could.
Bob!
All right, hands in. All right, sell some burgers!
Sell some burgers.
Here's Sarah Larson, a longtime staff writer.
I've been a fan and admirer of Lauren's work since I first encountered it and him in the mid to late 90s. We were both living in Boston and working in the world of writing and comedy. We were used to The Simpsons being brilliant and kind of crazy, but this was funny in a different way. It's a mainstream-looking family comedy. They're a regular family. They run a burger restaurant. They have neuroses and vulnerabilities, but they're also very plucky and very creative, and they really love each other. They're weird, but they accept each other as they are, and they're always trying to make the best of everything.
After a decade on television, a Bob's Burgers movie just came out, and it's called, you guessed it, The Bob's Burgers Movie. And it's written and directed by Lauren Bouchard. Sarah Larson talked with him last week.
I was so excited when I found out that you were making a movie because I just had a feeling that what I love about Bob's Burgers on a small screen would just explode into glorious, wondrous, exciting stuff on a huge screen. Can you tell me about what intrigued and excited you about the possibility of making a movie as opposed to a show?
Yeah, it's sort of two parts. I think that one part is the easy part that probably all of us share, which is I love movies. I love going to movies. I love watching movies. I have always loved movies. And so that part was just built in, right? And then separately, there's the the who do you think you are, you know, just pure gall to think that we could make one. And that happened in a very specific way, too. I remember clearly when we were quite sure that we shouldn't make one.
Why?
That was
what was that all about?
Well, that was just simply doing the show. We spent so many, you know, seasons on the bubble, as they say. We were never a sure thing, you know, to get renewed. We always fought for our dinner, and kind of in a way got used to that. You know, it was like working in an emergency room. You know, we were just under pressure all the time, and when a fan, and it was always at first the fans who brought it up. When a fan would say you should make a movie, it was kind of like, no, don't say that. You know, we can barely make this show. You know, we don't even know if we're going to get picked up. And so it felt I would squint at that and recoil with a little bit of fear.
Can we back up and talk a bit about how you got into animation in the first place and your evolution as a writer and director and composer and so on?
I love telling the story because it's you know, it's a study in luck, in sheer incredible luck on a you know, galactic scale. I was raised by creative artistic people. I had many creative and artistic urges, but I got a little derailed. Mm. My mother died when I was a teenager, and I had a few years of drifting a bit. And I did not finish high school, and I was working mostly bartending. Despite not finishing high school, I got a high quality education up until that point, I should say, because my father was the art teacher at a private school in Cambridge, Mass. And so my sister and I got a full ride there. And so I, as part of that, I had known this guy, Tom Snyder. He had been the science teacher at the school, at the grade school I went to. Hmm. You know, he was a really fantastic teacher and just a magnetic personality. Hmm. And so, and I think I had piano lessons from him for a time. I was connected to the guy. He was a sweet presence in the, you know, my middle grades, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. Then he left teaching. And I, you know, to some extent had stayed in touch. I'm 23 years old. I am quite sure that I have wrecked my chances of having the life that I had imagined for myself, which is to say a creative life. I was taking, you know, classes at the Cambridge Adult Ed Center. I was thinking maybe I could try to be a writer or a cartoonist or something. I had this sense that there was a job for me that, you know, combined my interests. I even had a sense that animation would be good. I'd been watching The Simpsons. It had come on, I think, maybe when I was about 18. And so I understood this, that there was this world, but I had no idea how to access it. I had no sense that I could figure out a way for me to get into it. I run into Tom Snyder in Harvard Square, and I'm coming out of an art supply store. I believe he's on his way to a funeral. We just cross paths on the street. And he says, "Hey, do you still draw and stuff?" And I say, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, come see me. I might have some work for you. I've been getting into animation."
Wow.
And I knew it. I knew right then and there I was getting lucky. I experienced clarity like you wouldn't believe. I basically said, "I'll do anything." He said, "Okay, it's not going to be much money, and I can't promise anything, and this animation thing may not pan out." But it did. He had the great idea to team up with Jonathan Katz, this local comic. They had the great idea to make Jonathan into the therapist and then have other comics be do their stand-up routines, but have it be as if they were in therapy.
You know, Katz, what is wrong with me?
Well, you know, that's not such a simple...
Come on, you bloodsucker. How long are you going to suck off my teat before you cure me? Fix this! Fix this!
When I first saw Dr. Katz and then Home Movies, you know, we were used to this wonderful gift of The Simpsons in our cultural landscape, but the aesthetic that you guys had and the way you were doing what you were doing felt so new and so thrilling and different because it felt conversational. It felt more realistic in the way that, you know, it had pauses. It sounded like the way people really talked.
To be fair, we wrote scripts for Dr. Katz, but they were treated somewhat as a safety net rather than as the script, the way we normally understand it. So we would have the actors improvise before they'd even read the script. We didn't want them to be colored by it.
Yeah.
The improv was really king.
Right.
Even now, I tremble to think what one of those scenes would look like. You know, if we'd written, you know, Dr. Katz makes a joke, Ben laughs, Ben makes a joke, Dr. Katz laughs. It's going to be treacly. But when it was improvised and discovered in the moment, it wasn't. Or I hope it wasn't.
And those shows were really beloved by the people who saw them, but a lot of people didn't see them. Nope. And I just, you know, it was such a tragedy in our world when Home Movies was on for a few episodes, and it was excitingly, you know, on buses that would go by, and I'd go, what's happening? And then suddenly it was gone and replaced by a show called Shasta McNasty. It was like, what is happening?
I used to tell people we weren't just canceled, we were extra canceled. The guy called after our first episode aired, and he said, your ratings were so bad, I would be fired if I even suggested you had a chance at renewal.
Yike.
Yeah, I got extra canceled. We got canceled, and then he kind of just like pushed the coffin lid closed as I was still trying to, you know, wedge my fingers out.
Can you just tell me a bit about creating Bob's and what that moment was like and what you were looking for?
I had been thinking about a family that runs a restaurant. I'd been thinking about it for years, in fact.
Why?
I'd had a few iterations. I just was fascinated. I'd worked in restaurants, and I had, you know, frequented restaurants where the kids were, you know, behind the counter. And, you know, it's just evocative of a certain kind of childhood, and I just was excited by that. So we made, in this first iteration, we made the family also cannibals. So a family that runs a burger shop, finding victims, grinding them up, making burgers out of them, Sweeney Todd style. We did not get very far. Blessedly, the network simply said, we love the idea of a family runs the restaurant. You don't need the cannibalism. Why do you want the cannibals? And I basically was just felt relief.
Huh.
You know, as I said, I think you're right. I think you're right. I don't know. I put it in out of fear, and if you don't need it, then I certainly don't need it. So we suddenly released from that feeling that we had to be that, you know, edgy and that sort of high concept, and we could simply be, I don't know what Bob's is. Let's call it low concept, a family that runs a restaurant. That was it. That was the hook. And they were happy with it, and so was I.
There's something I love about the way that the movie opens as it begins. You know, they're all worrying about money. They've got this loan that they have to pay back very fast.
We have a meeting this morning, and we're going to ask for an extension on a loan payment.
Oh, fun.
And we really, really need to get that extension.
And they're also thinking about their summers and who they're going to be this summer and what's going to happen this summer.
Only one more week of school, and then I'm Summer Tina. And big things are coming for Summer Tina.
Big things like that heat rash you get sometimes?
Bigger.
You know, they all have these sort of beautiful notions of what might happen. And here you are. You've got this movie that's opening as the summer begins. It's a real summer movie. What are your thoughts about the summer and you and what will come of all this? What would you like for the summer?
I mean, you can imagine what I'd like. It's not hard to picture. But I go into this coming weekend with a lot of, fear, I guess, frankly. I'm being a bit Bobbish here, if I may use the characters to define my moment. But we are still a small movie. We aren't a big movie. It's a 2D animated movie. But I guess what I want to say is it is a smaller movie. It's a big movie in terms of our ambition of the storytelling and the scope and the spectacle, but I just don't think that I am going to be happy if I think this movie is going to be some kind of mainstream success, and then I find out I'm brought back to earth when the box office numbers come in and it doesn't compare, you know, to Sonic 2 or, you know, some Pixar movie or, you know, some movie, you know, animated movies have, you know, they can be incredibly successful. And I would love for that to be the case, but I also am fine if our movie is just beloved by the people who find it and who who wanted that, be they fans or new fans, and I want to stay in that zone. I'm trying really hard to stay there so that I'm not knocked around by lukewarm reviews or lukewarm box office, because that my little soul can't take it if I let myself dream too big about the summer success of Bubs the movie. I think I'll be disappointed.
Well, you know, I think the thing I love about the Belcher family and the show and the movie is that whatever combination of good and bad that's going on all around them, they will just make the best out of whatever happens to be going on. And it makes you feel like, well, we can do that too, you know.
Optimism is a very powerful thing. We were making this movie during Trump, during COVID, and all the other things that are, really heavy in this moment. And we're raising families in this time. And optimism, it isn't cheesy, and it isn't just wishful thinking. It is, in fact, a stance. It's a choice. And it isn't because you expect a good outcome. It's because to face the future with a pessimistic attitude is worse for you no matter what comes. And I know that sounds funny given that I just predicted doom and gloom for the Bob's box office. But in fact, that's, I think, still exercising a sort of a double Dutch kind of backwards optimism, but it still feels like I'm just trying to imagine the best path for the movie that doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be a box office smash in order to succeed.
Exactly. That is beautiful.
Sounds like pretzels. Oh, thank you. I'm glad you think so.
Lauren Bouchard, the creator of Bob's Burgers, talking with The New Yorker's Sarah Larson. The Bob's Burgers movie is out now. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Peter Bresnan, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with help from Allison McAdam, David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen.
We had additional help this week from Michael May.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.